Chapter 73. The Dardanelles and Venizelos. After tearing the German and Austrian empires apart, the Allies turned their attention to the Ottoman Empire. The empire extended from the Balkans to Iraq and the Sinai. It was the third and last bulwark against the spread of communism. But the Allies gave little thought to communism in those days, since they were principally bent on acquiring the Ottoman Empire for themselves. Germany enjoyed a position of great influence in Turkey before the war. Its exports had, within 5 years, increased 350% and constituted 21% of Turkey's total imports. British business as a result had seen its share of the Turkish market fall from 60% to 5%. Whose fault was it? The Germans were selling superior products and services at a cheaper price than the British. There was no magic, just a preference for what was better and cheaper. Furthermore, the Germans had come to the marketplace without armed violence, unlike the Allies in other parts of the world. Imperialist gunboats were always behind the latter's traders. Germany's trading success in Turkey was being duplicated in more than 50 other countries around the globe. People were increasingly buying German goods because their quality was better. Even today, German goods are highly appreciated in the world marketplace, despite the blows of two devastating lost wars. Their Germans have always acknowledged that a nation's strength relies on its workforce. In 1914, they were victims of their own success. The vaunted British fair play, which could have been expected to result in the congratulation of a competitor, was not a factor in 1914. Instead, Germany was earmarked for destruction for the sin of producing better goods than its competitors. The Allies did not look within their own ranks to evaluate whether a failing work ethic or discipline had contributed to their failures. They blamed the German qualities of hard work and perfectionism. The British financiers were determined to stop German trade from expanding as if it were encroaching on some divine right monopoly to British world trade. Germany's expansion in Turkey was the result of 1,000 British moves to thwart German trade by sea. If Germany could not expand by sea, it would do so by land. The relationship between Turkey and Germany in 1914 was excellent. Turkish leader Enver Pasha had invited General Lyman von Sanders to reorganize the Turkish army, which had incurred severe defeats against Pan-Slavic forces. The move had infuriated the British and the French governments, although they saw nothing wrong in enlisting hundreds of thousands of conquered people in their own armies. In 1914, Indians, Arabs, Africans, Asians, and others were thrown into a European war by the Allies against Germany. On July 28, 1914, Winston Churchill committed an act of rare impudence, which only brought the Germans nearer to the Turks. For many years, Turkey had felt menaced by the Serbs, who were Russia's Balkan agents. Lately, they had been informed that an imminent attack was about to be launched against Constantinople. On July 27, 1914, the Turks sent emissaries to Berlin asking for help to fend off the danger. Churchill knew nothing of the proposals at this stage, he admitted so himself, but proceeded to swindle Turkey out of several million pounds sterling. In 1912, the Turkish government had appealed to its citizens to subscribe enough money to buy two warships from Britain. The price was enormous for the impoverished Turks, but it was felt imperative to counter the Russian navy. Turkish sailors were in London on July 1914 to take delivery of the prepaid warships. Without any explanation, Churchill seized the vessels. In his own words, "On July 28, 1914, I requisitioned the two dreadnoughts built for the Turkish Navy." Without further ado, the piratical British pocketed the blood money of millions of poor Turks. Turkey had committed no acts that could remotely be interpreted as hostile to London. Yet Churchill decided Britain needed ships even if they did not belong to the British, as well as the money that had gone to pay for them. Churchill bragged of this high sea robbery with arrogance. 500 Ottoman sailors had arrived in London to man the first ship. The captain asked for delivery of the ship. He threatened to fly the Turkish flag and board his men. "At this terrible moment, I gave on my own responsibility the order to stop by force of arms, if necessary, any attempt of this kind. This decision was only motivated by the interests of our navy, to which the two dreadnoughts would bring essential support. The dates must be carefully noted. On July 28, 1914, Churchill requisitioned the two warships. On July 31, he was ready to stop by force the Turkish sailors from taking delivery of their fully paid-for ships on the grounds they were needed by the Royal Navy. It was only 5 days later that the British government declared war on Germany, on August 4, 1914. Thus, just as officially backed British pirates had seized so many ships on the high seas, Churchill had seized in peacetime two ships from a friendly foreign country. This flagrant act of piracy provoked in the Turks a violent rage, which Churchill flippantly acknowledged. It has been said that the rage thus provoked in Turkey contributed in throwing this empire into the war against us, World Crisis, page 355. How could it be otherwise? The Turks had experienced, before the whole world, the humiliation of being publicly robbed by haughty London corsairs. On August 11, Turkey would buy from Germany two cruisers which had successfully crossed the Dardanelles, the Goeben and the Breslau. Positioned strategically in the Black Sea, it would from now on prevent any supplies from reaching Britain's Russian allies. The Turks had good reason to protect Constantinople. In the first week of hostilities, the British king had told his first cousin Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, "Constantinople is yours." Although the old metropolis had lost some of its commercial importance to Salonika, Smyrna and the Suez Canal, the Turks regarded it as the religious and historical center of the Ottoman Empire. The Russians also regarded Constantinople as part of their heritage, the religious and cultural inspiration of Russia. They were also determined to remove the Turkish stranglehold on their trade. The Allies had encouraged the Tsar in pressing his claims and had signed in February 1917 an agreement recognizing Russia's ownership of the Bosphorus, Armenia, Anatolia, and even Jerusalem, which, like Constantinople, was another holy place for the Russians. Turkey was hesitant, despite its wounded national pride, about becoming involved in the war. But as the British and Russian governments tightened the noose around its borders, its leaders felt it had no other alternative. On October 29, 1914, Turkey finally joined the war on the side of Germany. During February 1915, the Turks tried to reach the Suez Canal, without much success. Germany dispatched General von Falkenhayn on a second offensive, and the British were dealt a severe blow that brought the Turks almost to the eastern bank of the canal and almost cut the British Empire in two. Churchill later counterattacked in the Dardanelles. On March 18, 1915, he sent the Allied fleet to blockade the Bosphorus, although Admiral Sir Jacky Fisher and General Lord Kitchener had been opposed to the idea. The most powerful French and British ships blew up one after the other in the heavily mined waters. It was a terrible defeat, with a third of the entire Allied fleet and thousands of young sailors sent to the bottom of the Aegean Sea. Churchill's venture provoked widespread indignation, and he was forced to resign from the cabinet. Not for long, however. Churchill donned a uniform, and accompanied by his dog, went on to strut on the Flemish front playing soldier and posing dramatically. The English commander quickly returned Churchill to the House of Commons, demanding that he not wear the uniform again. London, smarting from its naval disaster in the Dardanelles, decided to organize a face-saving expedition on Turkish soil. Troops from all parts of the empire were gathered along with several French regiments to storm the shores of the Gallipoli region. The campaign ended in a frightful massacre. Then London decided to launch what was left of the Gallipoli Corps on a new campaign in nearby Salonika. This province was part of Greece, a neutral country, and Greece's King Constantine protested vehemently the British invasion of his country. British government, which had howled so much when the Kaiser had taken the Belgian shortcut to France, saw nothing wrong in violating Greek neutrality. They justified their action with the help of one of their local agents, Eleftherios Venizelos, a lawyer and politician from Crete. Venizelos patterned himself on the bombastic Churchill, and believed the British were invincible. "Britain has always won the last battle of all the wars it has waged," he was fond of saying. Venizelos was financed by London to plot against his king and to open the gates for Allied troops to land in Athens, where they fired on the population and expelled the king. Churchill himself acknowledged that French troops occupied Athens and expelled Constantine with full British backing. World Crisis, Volume 4, page 378. Churchill saw Greece as a British satellite, which would ensure the maritime link with India, Australia, and the Far East. A new king, Alexander, ready to do British bidding, was installed. After the war, Alexander, king of the Hellenes, was bitten by one of his monkeys, dying 3 weeks later. The British pushed Venizelos to take over. In order to give himself the legitimacy he lacked, Venizelos organized a plebiscite which would confirm him as ruler of Greece. Greek voters obviously did not share his enthusiasm for his British patrons. He was soundly defeated and fled into retirement on the French Riviera. The Greeks had instead voted overwhelmingly for King Constantine I, who returned in triumph to Athens. In 1916, however, the British had offered extraordinary inducements to Venizelos as a reward for overthrowing King Constantine, Thrace, the Black Sea, Smyrna and Anatolia, the present-day Turkey. Just as they had promised Palestine to the Jews and Tyrol to the Italians, the British had long recognized that promises were the cheapest currency to pay for immediate favors. There would be no doubt that if Venizelos had expressed the desire to claim Tibet or Hawaii, the British would have promptly promised these lands. All these territories so generously dispensed in the darkness of secret treaties had, however, been promised twice or three times to other countries in order to bring them over to the Allied side in the war. No country knew at the time that there were other beneficiaries. The revelation of British double dealing would come in 1919, when all those who had been lured into the war would come to claim their due at the peace conference. The British had promised various Arab chieftains territory and influence as a way to offset the Turkish leadership. One sheikh who took the bait was the Emir of Hejaz, a desperately poor tribal chief whose territory happened to include Mecca, the holy city for all Muslims.